will be produced by Hansard. The committee acknowledges that there could be media interest and we allow the media to film proceedings unless any witness raises an objection. But I do remind all witnesses that in giving evidence to the committee, they are protected by parliamentary privilege. It's unlawful for anyone to threaten or disadvantage a witness on account of evidence given to a committee, and such action may be treated by the Senate as a contempt. It is also a contempt to give false or misleading evidence to the committee. The committee prefers to take evidence in public. However, under the Senate's resolutions, witnesses do have the right to request to be heard in camera. It's important that witnesses give the committee notice if they do intend to ask to give evidence in camera, and the committee may also determine the proceedings do take place in camera. If a witness objects to answering a question, the witness should state the ground upon which the objection is taken, and the committee will determine whether it will insist on an answer, having regard to the ground which is claimed. If the committee determines to insist on an answer, a witness may request that that answer be given in camera. A witness called to answer a question for the first time should state their full name and the capacity in which they appear, and witnesses should speak clearly into the microphones to assist Hansard to record proceedings. And the committee has already agreed, that answers to questions taken on notice at today's hearing should be returned by Wednesday, October 31. So I now declare it open and welcome representatives from the Kelso Lawyers and from Shine Lawyers. Information on parliamentary privilege and the protection of witnesses and evidence, I think, have been provided to you, correct? The committee has your submissions. I now do invite each of you of your organisations to make a short opening statement. And at the conclusion of your remarks, I will invite members of our committee to put questions to you. And for the Hansard record, as I mentioned before, will you please state your full name and the capacity in which you appear today, Mr. Kelso?
Thank you, Senator Hinch. Peter Leslie Kelso is my full name, and I am the Principal and Director of Kelso Lawyers. Do you want me to give my opening statement?
Please do.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I wish to thank the Joint Select Committee for, firstly, the invitation to make a written submission, and also to thank the Joint Select Committee for the invitation to appear today to speak to these submissions and to assist the committee with any questions that they have. I've been looking forward to this opportunity. I have a lot to say about this wretched redress scheme that has been flown through Parliament. My firm is in a unique position to advise this committee on what changes need to be made to this particular legislation. I myself, as is evident online, I've made no secret of it, I grew up as a ward of the state. I was in foster care for 13 years. I suffered a level of physical abuse, which I've recorded on the internet and described. I suffered forced separation from my siblings. I did not see my brothers and sisters for 17 years. The reason I'm in Newcastle now is because when I found them when I was in my early 20s, they were all in Newcastle. I grew up in Sydney, so when I was married, a few years later, I moved to Newcastle so I could spend the rest of my life with them. I didn't know that one day that my experience as a young child and a young man in state care would one day be the key that opened many doors for me, and that I would be in a position now to help others. Because, you see, I've done well for myself in life, but I'm a rarity. The vast majority of people raised in state care or abused as children have not done well for themselves and actually were set up for a lifetime of struggle. I carry no bitterness towards my foster parents. They are both deceased now, but I forgave them many years ago. So when I recount things that they did to me, I do so only out of fact and history, but there was no bitter feeling attached. I'm joined today by members of my firm, as you can see by our surnames, two of my members here, my son and daughter. So Kelso Lawyers has in the last number of years become a family affair, and I'm very proud that my children have joined me in my crusade. And this is all we do in our firm. This is all we do is compensation for victims of institutional child abuse. When the Royal Commission was announced, I dropped everything. Everything else that we did as a firm, I dropped, and we devoted our entire resources to doing this type of work. As you, the committee would know, I'm very active on social media. When the Royal Commission started, I started a Facebook page for news and updates on the Royal Commission. The Australian Government solicitors worked with me in the early stages to make sure that there was no conflict or confusion there, and we have shown by our record that we have assisted many, many, many people in this country to get information about how to approach the Royal Commission, information on how to seek compensation and seek apologies from the responsible institutions. We continue that work today. And now with the National Redress Scheme, we assist as many people as we can with information about the Redress Scheme, the things that they should be wary about, the things that they should know. I can tell the committee that there are many things that I'm not happy about with the redress scheme. I support a redress scheme, and I say a redress scheme, but not the one that has materialised before us, because it is substantially not the redress scheme recommended by the Royal Commission. I do wonder if Justice McClellan was brought here for his comments, whether he would think that this particular redress scheme bore any resemblance to the one that he recommended. I think that that would be very interesting indeed. Now, one other thing I would say is that I have prepared a list of questions for the committee to consider. It's the document headed up Important Questions. And I've put myself in the position, if I was in your seat on the Joint Select Committee and I was wanting to ask questions of other parties called here in the next day or two, these are the questions I would be asking them to get to the truth of the matter. And when you read those questions in your own time, you will realise there's an underlying theme to those questions. You'll realise why those questions are being asked and what the point is of those questions. Now, I'm joined here today by Shine Lawyers. It's a privilege to share the table with them. They are fellow private practitioners like ourselves, plaintiff practitioners. They do an enormous job getting the information out there to the public and to victims. And I would ask the committee to look at it this way, that you have before you Kelso Lawyers and Shine Lawyers. I see that the Australian Lawyers Alliance, I think, is next up. Amongst the three of those parties, I would ask you to give a lot of weight to the things that we tell the committee. We are practitioners. We actually make a living from doing this. Myself, I've mortgaged my house some time ago to put my family wealth on the line for what I believed in. Other practitioners do the same thing. We are not funded by the government. You cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve two masters. Other parties appearing today are funded, many funded by the Commonwealth Government. There are some who take a seat on the Advisory Council. I'm not sure if they're funded, if they're paid for that position, but all those institutions receive some form of government funding. One institution, I'll name them no more, describe themselves as an independent agency on their website. They are not independent. They're nowhere near independent. They receive government funding, and if we saw the terms of that funding, one might see that they even agree not to be critical of the government. Now, finally, I'd say that I am paying the price for being critical of this government. I am paying the price for this. We have legal action started against us by the Department of Social Services. In the list of questions that I've given you, there are a number of questions I've asked you to consider putting to the Department of Social Services. We are paying the price for our criticism. I've put several criticisms on my website. on the Facebook site. I spoke to the ABC Radio PM program last week, and the department will not speak to me anymore because they were not happy with the comments I made on that program. Now, you're not here to make judgment on the Department of Social Services. We're here to see what we can do to improve the National Redress Scheme. So I'll wind up my comments there. You can tell by my comments that I have a particular attitude. I have a particular passion, you might call it, to use a cliche. And that passion is born out of the fact of where I come from personally, what my family knows, the risks that we have taken to assist survivors, and what we know is right for survivors. We have acted for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of survivors. We have appeared at the Royal Commission. I have been in the witness box at the Royal Commission. We have travelled Australia assisting victims. We offer what I think is probably the most affordable legal service to victims. We do not charge on an hourly basis. We do no win, no fee. And we are very proud of that. In fact, I have an opinion piece on my website describing our costs agreement and why I developed that cost agreement in the form that you find it today and why I'm proud of that. So thank you for your time. I hope that wasn't too much or too overwhelming. And I hand over to you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kelso, thank you for that. And before I go to Mrs. Flynn, I did this on Monday in Melbourne. Can I raise the elephant in the room? Because it is a problem we have. We are shackled by the terms of this Royal Commission. We had Frank Golding give very good evidence from CLAN in his personal capacity, even though he's a vice president of CLAN as well. I've called for a Royal Commission into other forms of physical abuse. We are restricted to only sexual abuse under the terms of our committee and under terms of redress. People who were abused as children, people who were used as child slaves by institutions, they were used as gardeners, they had their feet crippled. All that sort of stuff we are well aware of, and we're trying to find ways through it. On the other issue, the $200,000 maximum, which suddenly came down to $150,000, which I find abhorrent, we cannot, even as chair of this committee, I cannot find out who made that decision to drop it. We have tried to, I promised to try to get it back up to $200,000, which is what the Commission and even the Catholic Church agreed to at hearings we had last year. But I've been warned by the government that if I push it and keep pushing for it, it's going to go back, has to go back to the New South Wales government, back to the Victorian government, and we could be two more years before we get anywhere. And the sad thing is that victims are dying. There's people who are 60, 70, 90 years of age, and they need their redress now. So with those restrictions, we're as frustrated as some of you are about some of the areas we were going here. The other one that I'll come to Mrs. Flynn in a minute, but the other one that we have been, just to bring you up to date on what we were talking about at length with many, many witnesses over the weekend, as to how on earth somebody can make a bureaucratic judgment that penetrative sex is somehow worthy of more money than non-penetrative sex. And that is something which has been, I'm sure, will canvass even more, but it has become up. So, Mrs. Flynn.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today. My name is Lisa Marie Flynn, and I am Special Counsel and the head of our National Abuse Law Team at Shine Lawyers. We have a team dedicated to assisting survivors.
Can you invite a little bit further?
Sorry? We have a team dedicated to assisting survivors of abuse, and I've been involved in representing survivors of abuse for over 20 years now. And in that time, it's given us, similar to Mr. Kelso, unique insights in relation to the needs of survivors, as well as observations in relation to the behaviours of defendant institutions as they address these claims. I just have really three areas that I wish to talk about and address the committee on today. The first is that there have been positive outcomes in terms of the introduction of the National Redress Scheme. However, it has also introduced poor outcomes, and just to touch on those. And then finally, some simple proposals that I think could, with respect, eliminate some of those poor outcomes that we've seen with the introduction of the National Redress Scheme. So the introduction of the National Redress Scheme as an option for survivors of child sexual abuse, I think overall the introduction of a scheme has been a really positive step for this country. It was one of the key recommendations of the Royal Commission in relation to redress, and it will assist many survivors of abuse who otherwise would not have been able to access an acknowledgement of what they've been through, some type of financial redress and assistance and counselling, which are all designed to allow them to allow survivors to continue to move forward with their lives. However, there have been some poor outcomes and also some unintended consequences of the introduction of the National Redress Scheme. And many submissions, and also what you spoke about, Mr. Cherry, in terms of some of the unfair aspects of the National Redress Scheme as it was handed down. So the assessment matrix leading to unfair fair results, the cap being below what the Royal Commission recommended, eligibility restrictions, which really mean that it is unfair and discriminatory against classes of people. The restrictions in the counselling, and also in how it looks at prior payments. But that has been really canvassed quite heavily, those issues, in the submissions before the committee. There have also, in our observations, been some unintended consequences of the National Redress Scheme in terms of changes that we've seen in the behaviour of some institutions as they respond to civil claims brought by survivors of abuse. And just in terms of some of the time frame of looking at the behaviour of defendant and responsible institutions. So prior to the Royal Commission, we had a situation and an environment where it was very difficult for survivors of abuse to bring civil claims. So, and I've been well canvassed by the Royal Commission, limitation laws, difficulties with the identity of defendants, and all of those made it, was an environment where defendants relied on technical legal defences, offered very small amounts of redress, and survivors were in a position where they had a gun placed to their head, basically, to accept a very small amount or run their chances at court, where majority of these matters failed because of technical limitation defences usually. Then came the Royal Commission, and there, with that came a lot of the learnings and the research, and we learnt more about survivors and the amount of time that it takes for people to come forward. We've seen changes, and what we saw also was changes in the way that defendant institutions responded to civil claims. In some cases they were, so at a federal level we saw the Attorney General make a direction, which is only in effect, I think, until April next year, but not to rely on the time limitation defence. We saw the establishment, and this was subject to Royal Commission, a public hearing, but the Defence Force responding in a way where they agreed a collaborative framework where instead of forcing claimants and plaintiffs through litigation, they agreed to things such as joint medicals, informal settlement conferences, mediations, where they offered significant compensatory outcomes to properly compensate survivors of abuse within the Defence Force. We saw the meaningful direct personal responses and apologies being offered by defendants, including the Defence Force. And that was all around the Royal Commission time, a cynical view maybe, because there was always the threat of the Royal Commission then inquiring into how they were responding, and they'd have to give evidence for that. What we've seen, unfortunately, in some cases, and it's not across the board, but we have seen evidence of some behaviour from some defendant or responsible institutions change since the introduction of the National Redress Scheme. And we've had opponents pulling back from previously agreed collaborative arrangements where survivors are being told expressly or by implication that, well, there's a redress scheme and you're eligible for redress, so you go and do redress because we're not going to really engage collaboratively or properly with you because obviously it's going to be a lot cheaper for them if they only have to pay redress. And so some of our clients have been forced where previously we could have got had discussions in an informal settlement conference or a mediation. In some cases, we've been told, look, we're not going to pay more than what this person would be entitled to under the redress, despite there being evidence of the liability of the defendant and quantum in terms of the injury and the damage being far in excess of what they would be entitled to under redress. So some of those difficulties are now forcing clients and survivors of abuse to commence litigation and a litigious process, which is, as we know from the Royal Commission work, very re-traumatising for survivors of abuse. In terms of potentially what can be done to address this type of unintended, I think, consequence of the National Redress Scheme is that we note that recommendations 96 to 99 of the Royal Commission recommendations recommended that all governments and non-government institutions that receive civil claims involving survivors of child sexual abuse adopt model litigant guidelines and that they act in accordance with those guidelines to minimise re-traumatisation to survivors and avoid unnecessary adversarial responses in civil claims. So using the National Redress Scheme as a way to cut down a survivor's entitlements under common law is not model litigant behaviour. And so we suggest that there is a need for a government body to be tasked possibly with being responsible for managing issues where there are abuses of the scheme and so that they can be reported and dealt with, or alternatively a stakeholder body with representatives from survivor groups, survivors themselves, institutions, government that can meet and review the performance of the National Redress Scheme as well as the wider legal responses in relation to these claims, so that if any issues are identified that they can be dealt with, because currently the time for the legislated review of the scheme will be far too late, 2 years after its implementation, to really be able to ensure that it is fair and that all institutions are behaving responsibly and that the scheme is able to fulfil its intention, which is to make things easier and not harder for survivors of abuse. And I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you. Thanks. Mrs Flynn and Mr Kelso, on Monday we were receiving conflicting evidence. Some evidence came through quite strongly that because of the average payout, supposedly $76,000, many of it much lower than that, that was putting a cap or influencing civil actions. Because, as you're saying, some institutions say, well, we weren't going to pay any more than we're paying here. But we had somebody else then giving evidence saying that actually in Melbourne the payouts have been considerably higher than the average of redress. So what's your experience on that?
Ashley Kelso, Senior Associate at Kelso Lawyers. I think that the answer to that and the overriding issue here is accountability. Accountability, the threat of accountability to the Royal Commission is what got these institutions to start behaving properly in the first place. In Melbourne, in Victoria and now New South Wales, we have the benefit of limitation periods that have been rolled back for this sort of thing. So if you have a good case, if you have good evidence, and that can be difficult given the amount of time that passes in these matters, but when you have one of those sorts of matters, there is the legitimate, credible threat of actually litigating, and Victoria in particular has been proving to have a bit of, they've been quite accommodating with some of their decisions, their court decisions for survivors of abuse. There have been recent and quite favourable decisions there. So I would say that some of that is actually not to do with the redress scheme, but it's the fact that there's the genuine threat of it actually becoming litigated which is causing that.
And we've also had what's been described as the Catholic con from Melbourne response and towards healing, where very small payouts were made and people under pressure then also agreed to no further action and to confidentiality clauses, which which hurt a lot of people. Right. One other question before I go to Senator Moore. What's your reaction been to the actual application form itself? The 49 pages of it. We've found that some people have given evidence, which is, we call it the horse and cart in reverse, because of the caps on the payouts for counselling, is that some victims find the application form very traumatic, having to relive a lot of the stuff. But they're not eligible for any counselling because they haven't finished the application form. So if you've been traumatised by actually having to apply, you can't get anything and you can't be compensated because then the max is $5,000 anyway.
Peter Pham, solicitor at Kelso Lawyers. I'm actually here today and speaking as someone who has applied for several of our clients as their legal nominee under the scheme, and I'm in the process of preparing several more applications, and I'd like to make some comments about that process and the difficulties that you're describing, Mr. Chair, about the application itself, as well as the impact it's having on our clients in terms of how it's structured and the process. The first, I guess, step for any survivor is generally to visit the National Redress Scheme website and to call the National Redress Scheme helpline. I found both of those services to have several issues. The helpline, for example, when I've asked them questions about the application or the process of putting it together, I'm very frequently met with the answer that they don't know the answer to my questions or they haven't received the training. So for me, that's okay. I can sometimes find the answer elsewhere or I can improvise. But for a survivor of abuse, I have to ask the question how discouraging it must be to call the National Redress Scheme helpline and to be told that you can't be helped.
Question.
Sure.
We tend to be a little informal here, so yeah. You know that. So, and I'm letting Craig know because he hasn't worked with. We do jump in. So, has that been recent? I mean, certainly, we know it's been hasn't been up for very long, and many of the people have put in submissions, a couple of months ago. So, I'm just wanting to clarify that response from the hotline. Has that been recent, or was it when it was first opened?
Both.
So it's still going. That kind of response is still happening.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. In the same vein, the search function on the website for participating institutions is quite broken as well. Mm. Often a search that should only return a few results returns over 5,000 results, whereas often a search that should return a result doesn't return a result. And the reason I bring these things up is there isn't really another place where a survivor can actually search for a participating institution or to get some assistance from somebody at the scheme. Now that's the helpline and the website, which I guess is the first point of call. But when I've actually submitted applications on behalf of people, I've been in touch with the liaison officers at the scheme, as well as eventually their team leaders as well, the supervisors in that office. And I've had issues in the same vein with those people as well, which is more concerning. To me, the source of that issue is the drafting of certain provisions within the Act, which are ambiguous and which are causing confusion from the top all the way down to that team. And again, when I ask certain questions of the liaison officers and the team, and they're not particularly complicated questions, they're questions about whether evidence which is attached to the application will be considered or whether foster care abuse is considered and things like that, that I'm told that they don't know. So a few of the experiences I've had which have concerned me, I've been given incorrect information based on misinterpretations of the Act. I've been told by the liaison officers that things that they're saying are based on the Act when that's not in the Act at all. And I'm often just told by those liaison officers when I correct them and say, look, that's not in the Act or that's not the proper interpretation, they'll say, we're sorry, we don't have training in that, we don't know the answer, we're just reading off some kind of internal document that they seem to quote from, and they cannot go further than that. Again, I have to ask the question, and the question I ask myself is whether a survivor is expected to read the enacting legislation to correct liaison officers, which obviously wouldn't be something that would make much sense, and why these issues are existing in that liaison team in the first place, given that they're the people who receive an application and then are supposed to be communicating directly with survivors about whether the application is correct, what needs to be included in the application, and so on, so that it could then be passed on to the assessors. I don't think the cause of that problem is the staff themselves. I'm not trying to lay the blame at their feet. I don't even necessarily think it's their training. I think it's ambiguity within the legislation itself. We've actually provided a copy of a letter that we wrote to the minister about the main example of that ambiguity that we faced. And I'm saying I'm applying as the legal nominee of these applicants. When I've done so, the liaison team has contacted me and said, to be a legal nominee, you need to have a power of attorney or a guardianship over the person for whom you're applying. I've explained to them, and it's explained in the letter as well, which we've provided, but I understand that senators and members haven't had a chance to review that letter. But I've explained to the liaison team and the officers that the nature of a lawyer-client relationship is one where a lawyer must be empowered to act fully as the agent for their client. When our clients come to us, they need us to have the powers that legal nominees have. More importantly than that, the Act doesn't actually preclude, on a proper interpretation, lawyers from acting as legal nominee. It simply creates some ambiguity in the way that it's worded, and again, that's explained.
The actual form, sorry to interrupt you there, but the actual form, I think, does say, did somebody else assist you in preparing this application?
Yes. Isn't that
right? And it may not be a lawyer. It could be like in the case of Mr. Golding doing it as a virtually friend of court sort of thing.
And why do they need to know that? Mm-hmm. And the question was, why do they need to know?
And why they need to know. That's true. He said he didn't give permission for them to know everybody that he's assisted. One other thing I was going to raise with you, I think I'm right, Senator Moore, in saying that one thing that has been achieved, I hope, is that part of the trauma is reliving it, reliving your evidence. I think that they will now agree that if you gave evidence, you gave a stat deck somewhere, or you gave evidence to the Royal Commission, that should be enough to attach that to your application and not have to go through it again. Am I right on that?
That's what we've been told.
That's what we've been told. And is that your experience now, Mr. Kelso?
Sounds reasonable to me. Why someone would have to repeat everything they've already said, especially if they've had a private session with the Royal Commission, and all those private sessions were recorded. There's audio tapes. In fact, we've listened to many for our clients to do a transcription. So I don't know why you need to repeat. That's a fair point, and I sympathise with those people who have to go through it all over again. How many pages long is the application?
49.
It's 49, and as Mr. Famer said, there's ambiguities. Question 41, for example, foster parent abuse, is an ambiguous one too.
Well, it is an ambiguous one, because if the abuser in the family was under 18, that cannot be taken into consideration, as I understand it.
Oh, I haven't.
We
heard
have a case.
That one.
We have a case called, yes, Jenny the other day, yes, and she had repeated efforts, attempts of abuse and of exposure, but the perpetrator was under 18, was the son of the foster parents, not the foster father, and therefore they can't touch it.
Well, that's the first.
And she is not eligible. Apparently, we're told, yes, she is not eligible for any compensation for that.
Well, that may not be the case. We're about to roll out a class action against the New South Wales government on behalf of former state wards abused by foster parents. Now, I can tell you the common law position, not in Australia but in the UK and New Zealand, is that the government authorities are vicariously liable for foster parent abuse.
Because they part of the child.
That's there. A narrower. But yet in the redress scheme here, they talk about where you're abused in a foster care setting. Now, a foster care setting can include the children of your foster parents. I take it whether they're under 18 or over 18. It can be abused by the neighbours, by uncles, aunts, or whatever. It's a very wide thing. That's far more extensive than what was decided in the recent UK Supreme Court decision of Nottinghamshire. And I was surprised to see that in question 4. I thought the person who's drafted that question in the redress scheme application, it was not a lawyer, didn't know that the state governments are resisting liability to pay that. In fact, I think Lydia can explain, I think recently the Attorney General in New South Wales, Mr. Speakman,
said in the second reading speech in Parliament that that state governments are not liable for foster parent abuse. And the reason why, he said the reason why the Royal Commission didn't deal with the issue of state wards and foster parent abuse was because it was too broad or opened, you know, it exceeded their powers. And I'd never heard, I don't know where he got that from.
They didn't say that they didn't have sufficient control, which frankly is nonsense, because under the Child Welfare Act 1939, if you turn to Section 60 of that, and in particular, the government had the power to regulate everything from the sports team that the foster child joined to what religion they followed. So they could even dock the money paid to the foster parent if they didn't think the clothes were good enough they were buying for the child. So I'd say there's a fair amount of control. Yeah.
One of the questions that's been raised a lot, especially by clannies, has been that they resist and resent the idea of that the institutions are being given the information about their circumstances when the institution is being asked to pay the redress. Now, the argument I put forward is that if I'm an institution and I'm being told that I have to pay $50,000, I'm entitled to know the circumstances of what I'm paying for. Is that fair?
Yeah, I agree entirely with you, Senator. I understand the sentiment behind what the clannies are saying, and I've read that in the media some weeks ago. Yes, fair enough, but yes, if you put yourself in the shoes of the institution and they are in fact paying the money, they are entitled to have some important details. We have to be entirely fair.
The argument put forward by them, and a separate one, is that if it then goes to civil proceedings, that the institution has an advantage. But if you're in any court of law, you've got to hand over hand over material to the other side anyway.
Yeah. And if you accept money from the redress scheme, you can't go take civil proceedings. The door shuts.
Yeah.
Sorry, Lydia, I think you were going to add anything about that foster parent abuse and...
No, I think Ashley covered that. It's about the definition of what's akin to an employee, and to suggest that a foster parent is not akin to an employee is quite absurd, I think.
Yes,
and you're starting a class action against the state government.
Yes, we are. And what Lydia just said is the expression akin to an employee. For the Attorney General of New South Wales to tell his Parliament that foster parents are not akin to an employee is totally the opposite that the UK Supreme Court decided last October in a 4-1 majority that foster parents are akin to employee. And I think if you ask the man in the street about whether foster parents are akin to employees of the government, I think that would well and truly say yes, and that would pass the pub test. And I think, you know, for anybody to say that they're not and they lack control is quite frankly ludicrous, and seems to suggest that someone's just trying to avoid paying money.
And it'll become even more so if, in fact, the proposal goes through that foster carers are going to be paid $75,000 a year.
Yes.
Well, they must be employees then.
That's right. Yeah. Well, they get vetted and screened. You know, they get trained by the government or the agency they employ, paid monthly, visited regularly by case managers, and so forth. It's probably a more stricter and closer control than an employer has over employees.
Thank you. And I mean, certainly the points you've raised, we will be raising with the department. I'm interested from both your organisations, and Mr Kelso, you have pointed out that there are some difficulties in terms of communication with your company and the government. We won't go into the details, but we have seen what you've sent us. But also from Shine Lawyers, and in both your submissions, you have identified the long-standing engagement you have had in this area of law. What has been the process of the interaction with the government in terms of putting up your issues? And many of the issues you've put up have been put up by, you know, other people as well, and we won't go through them all, but thank you for all of them. When you do raise them, how can you raise them with the government? What is the process of interaction and your response? And Mr. Pham, I note your letter is the 25th of September. Unfortunately, that is still a pretty short time for government response, but I take it you haven't got one. I'm wanting to know what it's one of the issues that so many people have been wanting to be involved in this process. It seems to have been going on forever. And when you raise genuine concerns about how you think it could be done better, which is what both your submissions have indicated is your intent, How do you do that, and what's your response from government?
Thank you very much, Senator. I think one of the issues with the introduction of the National Redress Scheme is, as you have said, it's been talked about and it's been promised, and but there was very little detail provided at any really any early stage. So it was very difficult, one, to advise survivors as to what might be coming, very difficult to say how they would fit into the assessment criteria. And then it was released. Our feedback in relation to it is contained in our submissions primarily, and that's been our and putting information into submissions, our experience into submissions, and hoping
response from government
has been an invite to the well, we've been invited to speak today, but other than that, there's been no real response or engagement.
See, that's
with
not
us.
From government.
No, I understand that. I do understand that.
But it's just the goodwill, you know, to try and get the best possible result, knowing that there's no perfect result in this case, and we accept that. The consultation methodology around people with knowledge of law. So from your perspective, I don't want to verbal you, but from your perspective, there hasn't been a particular process to gather firms like yours and say what you've learnt from the cases you've put forth. That hasn't happened.
No, that hasn't happened.
Mr. Kelso?
Thank you, Senator. That leads me to think that there's no accountability of the National Redress Scheme, and the fact there's no appeal process. We've made submissions.
You've both made that point,
about
yes.
that, and yeah. I just ask Ashley to say something about a lack of accountability, and I think that might explain why there's difficulty in communication with the department. They may feel that they're beyond having to explain themselves because there's no accountability. That may have given rise to a particular culture, I'm not sure. I'm sure if you ask them, they would deny it. But I'll ask Ash if you could say anything.
I think I can certainly address your concern there. I think the answer, again, is accountability. What our experience is that these government departments are typically echo chambers in which they convince themselves by repeating to themselves the positions and the legal positions that they think are most favourable to their own financial and budgetary concerns. And what we find too is, I'm sure as our friends from Shine Lawyers have experienced as well, is you can end up going along to a mediation, negotiation, and what happens is they've come with the amount of money they intend to offer. That's it, and you can have it in one offer, or we'll break it into three for you so it can look like it's an actual negotiation. And the attitude that we cop, and I would never actually admit to this, but I mean, it's the only way to explain it, is they realise that most of the time survivors are just too damaged by the impact of the abuse that they've suffered to go through and endure full-on litigated court proceedings. Mm-hmm. And again, so that is been held against them the whole way through. The impact of the abuse that they suffered kept them from disclosing often for 20 years until well after the limitation period that used to be in place prevented them, and then the limitation period took over and drew that out, and now they find themselves precluded just through their own health from being able to make governments accountable for what happened to them back then. And I think that is the common theme running through the Royal Commission. The problem, a major problem that's going to underlie this redress scheme, even if we fix issues with the assessment framework, no system's going to stay good and be good without real accountability. You must have that feedback loop. You must have government departments and defendants must fear that someone external and independent to themselves will actually make them behave with intellectual honesty rather than what just suits them. And
also that recommendation of not having an external appeal came from the Royal Commission.
And that's
certainly that's been the fix that we've had, that on one level we actually said that the Royal Commission was the gold standard, that they had done all that work, more than ever any other nation's done in that space, and we wanted to go, you know, we wanted to follow their recommendations as closely as we could. And we pointed out the differences between the some of the recommendations of the Royal Commission and what has happened, and quite justly said we don't like this. But two things that the Royal Commission actually did have recommendations about were the indexation of payments, which has caused great outrage by many of our witnesses, and from the legal perspective I'm sure there's an interest in that as well. And the other thing was to make it as informal as possible and not have that kind of specific legalistic external review process. Now, that's the situation we're in. So I am drawn in this place because I think part of me was saying the Royal Commission should be it, you know, they said. But they're two particular issues that we've struggled with as well as a committee. So
there's another one, like from your experience and with your clients, I'm interested in your reaction to it, is that on the counselling, which is set at a certain monetary level, and for people, without getting all the stuff about regional and rural and the problem people have getting to a counsellor or having to change counsellors when you've got used to having one counsellor, the thing that's perturbing me is that you may have a need for counselling, and then you may use up your accredited counselling hours, and yet 30 years down the track, suddenly a Catholic priest is in court. And you're one of his victims, therefore it's going to trigger your need for counselling again. And so this, the way it's structured, I find it very, I can't handle it. So I'm interested in what your reaction would be to that.
It's another issue. The Royal Commission made one recommendation and the government response has been different.
Mm. It's interesting that after the Royal Commission began, the New South Wales Victim Services Counselling Scheme actually offered ongoing counselling to victims of institutional abuse. So the New South Wales scheme offers ongoing endless counselling. Why can't the redress scheme do the same?
Is it approved counsellors?
Yes.
And is it for all forms of abuse or just sexual abuse?
As I understand, it's all forms. If it's in an institutional setting, you can apply to have, I think it's 22 hours is the ordinary amount that people would get, but you can apply to have that extended indefinitely if you come within the Royal Commission.
We hadn't heard that detail. No. So we'll follow up. Thank you.
Senator Moore, if I could just respond to that issue of accountability. Mm. I believe it was the Independent Advisory Council that cited in the explanatory memorandum as having recommended against external review. And I have to say, as someone who's been in the trenches in both statutory schemes and in civil claims, you must have an external independent review process. You absolutely must have it. Our experience has been that when you don't have it, or when it is really quite expensive or onerous to access it, then assessors in statutory schemes will progressively become a law unto themselves. We have seen it time and again. So an experience we've had is the New South Wales Victims Comp Scheme, which is a statutory compensation scheme. Okay, so previously under the 96 Act, it was a reasonably simple process to you go internal review and then you can get that appealed again, merits review. But then under the 2013 Act, you go internal review and NCAT. NCAT's been very helpful, and it creates this useful feedback loop, which enables us to keep assessors honest. But when, say, you have a different situation, which is a transitional application under the New South Wales Victims Comp Scheme, they don't get NCAT. They have to go straight to the Supreme Court if they don't like the outcome. And it's very hard, you know, that it's hard to justify doing that in most cases. You've got filing fees, you've got the legal cost of doing that, and you've got the threat of an adverse cost order if you lose it. And what happens there is things start to get more and more off track. Okay, decisions start to become less and less generous. The financial and budgetary concerns start to be taken more and more into account. Applications that would previously receive this much money, a higher amount, it starts to dwindle down and dwindle down. And all of a sudden, you've got assessors refusing to agree with expert evidence that they actually commissioned. Because if they actually accepted that evidence, it would be impossible to avoid the result that the claimant is entitled to the higher sum of money. I conducted a matter in the Supreme Court myself just in late April in that case. There was a, it must have been a 20-page report from the psychologist going through absolutely everything of the client's entire psychiatric history, saying this poor guy is severely affected, and listing off all the ways in which he was affected, and I can tell you from meeting him, he really is. But the assessor, having not met the person and having no psychological qualifications themselves, dismissed all that because he was capable of riding a motorbike, which he subsequently crashed and hasn't been able to use. But because he was able to find some enjoyment in life by riding a motorcycle and playing Xbox, he apparently wasn't severely affected by his childhood abuse. This is the kind of erosion that you get. You must have external accountability. People cannot be a judge in their own case. There must be some way for the redress scheme to be held accountable, and I would say it would be very good to have that done by the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, full merits review, because people understand merits review. Judicial review, highly technical. Merits review, you're just saying that I didn't like the outcome, I think a more favourable one could be achieved. But as it is, what we've got here now is that the only option constitutionally for someone to challenge their redress scheme decision is to go to the High Court. So the Independent Advisory Council says we shouldn't have external review because it would be too time-consuming, costly, stressful, expensive for victims, and the effect of that decision is their only option is the High Court, which can't be excluded because of Section 75 of the Constitution. So I would say that is actually the most expensive, onerous and legalistic option there. So that's been the effect of that decision, whereas if they had have allowed just a normal merits review to the tribunal, everybody understands that. That's quick and simple. Our experience with NCAT is it's very accommodating, it's not stressful, it's flexible. People understand it, quick, cheap, done. And it helps to keep that feedback loop, which keeps the scheme healthy. So I have to disagree in the strongest terms with the idea that we should not have external review.
Anything more?
Mrs. Landry, I've asked them all. Mr. Landry, do you have any questions? In terms of the indexation, as lawyers, view on the question about the fact that anyone who's received any form of payment on this issue at any time in the past will have to have that compared to the payment now, and indexation will apply. With the view of the High Commission was that, the Royal Commission was that was okay, and it's in fact standard practice. Some of the cases that have come to us have shown really low payouts. Will in fact, as a result of indexation, mean that people get nothing?
Senator, I do think that is a concern. I do think that where prior payments are deducted, that any indexation should be in favour of the survivor rather than the institution, because there are examples of, because the small amount of redress was paid so many years ago, it is significant indexation, and then compared to this low amount that they're entitled to now under the current national redress scheme, it's not going to be. There will be cases where someone will not get anything, and we've seen some of those examples in the submissions made.
How would indexation be able to be used to benefit the survivor? How would that operate?
Not to benefit, but so that the decision not to index it, so that that would work in the favour of the survivor, in that they're not having to pay back a higher amount. So at the moment, the indexation works in favour of the institution.
Absolutely.
Whereas we think that should be in the other way around, to be in accordance with the scheme.
Yep.
Can I make another point on that? Why is it that the institutions get the benefit of indexation but not the survivors? So the maximum amount payable under the redress scheme increases as each year goes by, but not... increase. You get a high deduction if you're an institution as each year goes by, but as each year goes by, the survivors get less. So survivors get paid by the end of this scheme, they'll be continued to be paid in basically 2018 dollars by the time this scheme comes around, but institutions will get paid in the dollars of that day. How's that fair? So the actual buying power, the actual value of the redress they get, erodes over the course of the scheme. Now, in this state, Civil Liability Act, each year we come out with October, we increase the maximum amount payable in terms of a most extreme case under the Civil Liability Act, so that grows and keeps pace with inflation and the rising cost of living. Mm. So why can't that be the same for the redress scheme?
Chair, I just have one last question, if that's okay. This is a question in terms of legal process, or legal precedent, I think. One of the things that Senator Hinch mentioned earlier was in the model of how payment will be assessed, the issue of penetration has become the absolute baseline of what is serious and what is not. That's how I see it, the whole thing is based around about whether there's penetration or not, and if there's no penetration, everything is considered less traumatic and less serious. Is there a basis in law? I am struggling to see why this particular issue has been put as the absolute threshold of assessment in this model. And I'm asking, in terms of legal process in issues around sexual abuse, is the same absolute determinant on whether sex has been penetrating or not?
I would say most definitely not. So it works, it goes nearly opposite in terms of what the legal compensatory response is. It looks more to the impact that the abuse has had on that person, on the trajectory of their life, on their ability to work, on their ability to maintain relationships, on their need for future medication and future treatment, all of those things. So it's really based on the more so the impact of the abuse rather than what actually happened to them. And there's many examples within our own practices of people who have suffered horrendous abuse that wasn't penetrative, but was done in circumstances that was over a long period of time that caused so much harm and humiliation. And I think that's the issue that a senator has articulated, is that for those people to be told that they're not entitled to that extra $50,000 for those most severe cases is very damaging to a number of those clients.
We have a lot of witnesses discussing this at some length on Monday, and I was corrected because I raised the issue. So if you're an 8-year-old boy and you're forced to perform oral sex on a priest, is that, and I was told that constitutes penetration. Is that the way you interpret it?
Under the definition of penetrative abuse, so if an 8-year-old boy is violated by a priest, say that priest performs oral sex on that child, which is a story that we hear quite often in regards to clergy abuse, that would not be regarded as penetrative abuse because the child itself has not been penetrated. It
doesn't make sense.
No. And to suggest, as Ms. Flynn has said, that a victim of, say, 30 acts of indecent assault would receive less money than someone who was a victim of one incident of penetrative abuse is absurd. And from a lawyer's perspective, and even just a layperson, they would be horrified by that, because we look more for the injury that is caused, which in almost all cases is psychiatric injury. And the way that the matrix is created to cap compensation for impact based on the type of abuse solely doesn't make any sense. We can have two people that suffered very similar abuse, have very different experiences 30 years down the track. We can have someone who suffered abuse which objectively may be considered less severe, and they suffer a far more debilitating injury to someone who suffers objectively more severe abuse. And it just seems it's strange that the scheme, which is focused on victims of child sexual abuse, seems to miss that entirely.
If I could address Senator Moore, you asked about what the legal position is there. I mean, as a fundamental question of law, compensation is guided by what we call the restorative principle. So it's about how do we put the person who was injured back in their pre-injury position so far as money can do it. That's the law. And even goes so far as the eggshell skull principle, which is what Lydia is touching on there, which is to accept that, you know, even if the injury is far more severe than one would have expected would flow from a particular wrongful act, that does not cut down the compensation liability of the defendant. It's about the impact. Once you've established that there was a wrongful act, it's about how much damage was done and what is the financial cost of restoring to the person financially the damage and pre-damage position. So,
if I can add, I think that's particularly relevant, the eggshell skull principle. When we're dealing with forgotten Australians, we're dealing with people who were abused, often in state care. They came from backgrounds that often were traumatic. They entered into the system already vulnerable to injury. So we weren't dealing with people that were already at their, you know, top, you know, health and mental condition. So we can, most of our clients who were suffered abuse in state care, we would consider them eggshell skull. They were vulnerable to abuse before the abuse even happened. They were vulnerable to injury which flowed from that.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And apologies for arriving later, but thank you both for your submissions, both Shine and Kelso lawyers. I'm correct in saying no one has actually had a determination on any case of application that they've assisted in at this point?
That's correct.
Yeah, no one?
Our applications are in limbo because of the legal nominee issue.
Nothing to this date.
Because they are still doing their paperwork and haven't signed up to the scheme, is that what you're saying?
Well, sorry, I was saying that when I've made applications as a legal nominee on behalf of our clients,
yes,
those applications are in limbo because it hasn't been clarified whether a lawyer can act as legal nominee.
Right. Who is going to get back to you on that?
Hopefully the minister or somebody.
What time frame? You've been advised of when you would hear anything?
The liaison office and team leaders have told me that they can't help. They couldn't give me somebody who could help, so we wrote to the minister, the Honourable Paul Fletcher, and we're waiting a response. Waiting for a response.
How long ago did you write to the minister?
23rd of September.
Okay, thank you. And given that there's been no determinations yet, but I think it was in the Shine submission that I read you were experiencing, nonetheless, a discernible shift in institutions becoming less collaborative and less kind of conciliatory in their approach to work that you're doing. Can you just talk us through how that is playing out on the ground for yourselves, I guess,
sure,
and or as representing clients and the clients?
In some cases, where previously, before the National Redress Scheme, we were engaging in informal negotiations to avoid the need for sort of long litigious processes. So defendants were, as a result of the Royal Commission engaging with us, matters were resolving at an earlier stage. Apologies and acknowledgements in some cases were given. In some cases, since the introduction of the National Redress Scheme, we've had informal negotiations or, in some cases, defendant institutions pull away from previously established collaborative arrangements and saying to our clients, look, you are entitled to redress, you should go down redress. Mm-hmm. And so otherwise we're not going to offer more than what you would be entitled to at redress, mm-hmm, which is significantly lower than what they would be entitled to with a common law claim. Yeah. So what it's forcing is either clients that don't want to go through a long court process to either take the small amount that's offered or drop their case and go through redress, or if they want proper compensation for their injuries, to go through a longer process than what was previously as a result of the good work and the recommendations of the Royal Commission, where there had been a shift in defendants' behaviour.
Mm. Has that been the same experience for Kelso lawyers?
Look, I'll just quickly say, on a similar note, since the Royal Commission ended last December, this year, for example, I've had 5 threats of defamation proceedings against me by Catholic and Anglican bishops because they don't like what I write on my website. I've been approached by their lawyers threatening me, but I can tell you that none of them have started proceedings. They've all been dagger-rattling exercises because the Royal Commission's over, and as Ms. Flynn said, this seems to have, well, given some courage to these churches, and I've mentioned bishops themselves, you know, feel, you know, invigorated now, and they feel that the bad man's gone away. There's no longer the shadow hanging over them of Justice McClellan and his commissioners, and they feel now, they feel free to contact lawyers and write threatening letters to victims' lawyers now.
And can I just ask, if this hasn't already been asked, you've each made, you know, a series of recommendations in your submissions to this committee. Have you ever been asked or had the opportunity to put those in any form of consultation to government or, you know, in the design? Were you ever engaged in the design of the National Redress Scheme at any point? So subsequent to the implementation or to the enactment, have you had any opportunity to provide feedback prior to today?
No, the answer's from Shine.
No.
Thank you very much.
Can I just follow up on one point? Mr. Kelso, I was skimming my way through the Royal Commission report, which is a, you know, interesting thing to do, but thank you to the Secretariat for actually following up for me. The two comments that the Royal Commission did put about the review and appeal system were 61 and 62, and I should have them in my memory. Mm. A redress scheme should offer an internal review process, which it does, and a redress scheme established on an administrative basis should be made subject to oversight by the relevant ombudsman through the ombudsman's complaint mechanism. So in the actual Royal Commission, it doesn't talk about external review. And I take your point, and I actually agree, but it's just, I just wanted to make sure that, I mean, I just wanted to make sure I wasn't putting false things into the evidence.
Senator, if I could also just add to that too, it's a really important issue too, is the internal review process under the Redress Scheme is pointless, if I might say so, because...
it's an understandable point.
You
and
cannot
many people
put
have made
further
it.
Evidence on... to fix any shortcomings
and
the government.
Which both your submissions have made about, yes.
You're not allowed to see the guidelines on how they actually assess and take these things into account because in the explanatory memorandum they were concerned that people might actually use that to actually put together a proper submission, put together a proper application. We can't have that. And we should also make it ambiguous as to whether lawyers, private practitioners who are actually independent, can actually help people through their extraordinarily lengthy application process based on an act which the people operating it struggle to interpret themselves. And we shouldn't have external review because it would be legalistic to have someone with legal training actually help these people interpret it. And then when it comes to getting an internal review of the decision, it's just going to probably be the person in the next cubicle of the redress scheme. And given that they will have no fear that someone will actually take them to the High Court, they will have a fear of offending their colleague in the next desk if they overturn their decision, they're probably just going to affirm it. And if you can't put any more submissions or evidence on to fix shortcomings, then it's just going to be a rubber stamping exercise. And victims will just feel again, as they did back in their childhood, that their lives and their fates are being handed to them by the authorities and they just have to swallow it. There's nothing they can do. They've been told.
Members and senators, in my experience, if an institution says you don't need a lawyer, you need a lawyer.
The ombudsman has made a very detailed response to this committee as well, so it might be interesting to see from their point of view, their views. So thank you, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Kelso clan and Mrs. Flynn, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.